House Special Committee on Energy to order. Today, and I guess it's about 10 after. Today we have Representative Nagyak excuse. I should say Representative Higgins excused, Co-Chair Millett excused. Today's so far is Rep. Hughes and myself, Rep. Isaacson. And but excitingly, we have with us members of the Alaska Power Association. Before I introduce them, I want to thank the staff who are here, Catherine Eldemar, my committee aide, Jeff Turner, up here is committee aide for Co-Chair Rep. Millett, and the House Record Secretary is Deborah Tillinghast on my right, and on my left, the teleconference operator, Kathleen Nyssen. Excellent. All right, so today's purpose is to hear a following presentation from the Alaska Power Association, and with us we have Crystal Enqvist of the Alaska Power Association, Clay Copland of Cordova Electric Association, Joe Griffith of Matanuska Electric Power Association, and we'll let you go through, and this is being recorded so that our members and people of the public who would like to see this may do so online as well. So with that, introduce yourself, place yourself on the record, and as you wish, proceed.
For the record, I'm Crystal Enqvist with Alaska Power Association. Good morning. Thank you very much for this opportunity for us to address the committee. Very much appreciate it. The purpose of our presentation is to share with you our legislative priorities. Speaking with me today are Clay Copeland, he's the CEO of Cordova Electric Cooperative, and Joe Griffith, over here on the far left, he's the CEO of Matanuska Electric Association and ArcTech. And again, I'm Crystal Enqvist, I'm the Director of Member and Public Relations for Alaska Power Association. One thing I forgot to mention in the intro is Clay is also the co-chair of the APA Managers Forum. Again, we do appreciate this opportunity. What we're going to cover today, I'm going to give you some background on Alaska Power Association and talk to you a little bit about how we develop our legislative priorities. And then following that, Clay and Joe will go more in-depth into our legislative resolutions. And then we'll open it up for questions. So a little bit on Alaska Power Association. We are a 62-year-old trade association for the electric utility industry in Alaska. Our members are electric cooperatives, municipal-owned utilities, joint action agencies, and investor-owned utilities. Our largest member is Chugach Electric Association with 82,000 members. And our smallest member is Tenalian Electric Cooperative in the Lake and Peninsula Borough. And they have 135 meters. So there's a lot of diversity there within our membership. NAPA is a statewide organization, and you'll see that on the next slide. So if you look here on the next slide, it shows the widespread locations of Alaska Power Association member utilities. And you can see that we span the state from Barrow to Kodiak, and then from Unalaska to down the Inside Passage. And actually, as a side note, there could have been a lot more stars on that slide because Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, they serve 55 villages in western Alaska, and they're soon to finalize their purchase of the Bethel Electric Utility System. Next slide. So regarding the development of our legislative priorities, we do have a diverse electric utility membership, but Alaska Power Association is the organization where we come together to speak with one voice.
And Crystal, while you're on these pictures sometimes, if you could explain the pictures so we know the locations of these projects?
Sure. So in the upper left-hand side, that is a great shot of a transmission line down the Seward Highway heading towards Girdwood. On the left is a dam, in the lower left is a dam in southeast Alaska. I'm not sure which one that is. It could be Swan. Great. And then I believe the picture to the right is from Alaska Village Electric Cooperative and one of the villages where they have wind. And I apologize, I can't recall.
I think that's Pillar Mountain.
Oh, you know, you're right. That is Pillar Mountain and Kodiak. Thank you. Thank you, and I appreciate you calling that to my attention. Our issues, they're a combination of statewide as well as rural and rail belt focused. So regarding our resolutions process, like many trade associations, our members bring their issues to us in a very member-driven process. We have a resolutions
and Governmental Affairs Steering Committee. And that committee is composed of electric utility managers and directors from rural and urban utilities from across Alaska. And the committee, they're responsible for making recommendations to the APA Board of Directors on our legislative positions and the efforts on which we should focus. We also have the APA Managers Forum, and I know that you, Representative Isaacson, have addressed that group, and it's a group of electric utility CEOs. That group is co-chaired by Clay Copeland with Cordova Electric Cooperative, and then Brad Evans, who's the CEO of Chugach Electric Association. So the last part of the process is the APA Board of Directors reviews the resolutions and considers them for approval, and they receive recommended resolutions from our Resolutions Committee and then also from the Managers Group. And then they, in December, review them and then decide on which to focus our efforts. But, again, it's a very member-driven process, as it is with many associations, and it is the way it should be. Next slide. I'm going to quickly touch on the slide. I recognize it's text-heavy, so I don't expect you to read what's on it. But it is a summary of our resolutions at a glance. And as I mentioned earlier, they are a good combination of statewide, rural, and rail belt focused issues. The resolutions are not listed in priority. We do not rank our resolutions because of the diversity within our membership. And for example, a priority to Chugach Electric may not be a priority to Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. And again, we are the organization that comes together to speak with one voice.
A question on that. Since several people have asked about prioritization, and now with our budget cuts, we're definitely looking at having to prioritize projects. Is it possible in the future to be able to prioritize some of these projects so that we know where your membership is looking at statewide, you know, with a variety of projects that and issues that are being represented, which do you feel should go first, second, third? I know that we've been trained by our congressional delegation and the past few years here in the legislature. I know as a mayor, I got to where we stopped prioritizing because they said, wherever we have the money, we'll just send us your request, we'll try to fit it in. But now we need to have a stacking order. We need to figure out how do we develop our resources, and what's the priority then to the people who are the developers of that resource, yourselves, for example, in this case. So if you could in the future, or maybe even this year, if we have anything in motion already, let us know. It'll be very helpful.
Sure, we definitely want to be part of that process. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Thanks.
And we believe that the legislature's active support of our positions will enhance the electric utility industry's ability to provide safe, reliable, and affordable electric power to all Alaskans. So at this point, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Clay Copeland with Cordova Electric Cooperative and Joe Griffith with Matanuska Electric Association. And then following the presentations by Clay and Joe, we'd be happy to answer your questions.
Hey, thank you, Crystal. For the record, Clay Copeland, CEO of Cordova Electric Cooperative, and I'll try to answer part of your question. And I went to, I spoke with Sarah Fisher Goad a little earlier this week, and I know the AEA presented to House Energy earlier this week, and they do a great job of measuring and communicating the success and failures and implementations of their programs. And we want to try and give you a more qualitative feel for how these programs work for us, so the end users, and kind of take you past the numbers to the effectiveness and importance of these programs, and kind of how they fit together. So these next few resolutions are primarily rural-focused programs, and that's where there's a lot of benefit, but they're not exclusively. Most of the programs have benefits, direct benefits, to both urban and rural areas. So the Renewable Energy Grant Fund is a program. It's a brick-and-mortar part of our portfolio. And the way I look at a lot of these programs is they fit together and they address different parts of our energy problem. This is one of the actual brick-and-mortar build projects that incrementally chip away at the whole energy block and takes those little steps forwards. It's a great program. It's had a great success. It's well structured. It's well governed, and that process is really been effective. So in one of the things I wanted to try to share is that these projects can have a project success where it stays on scope and schedule and the project is successful of itself. But then you have to ask, what's the business success of that project? You know, you can have a project that runs really well and operates well, maybe it even delivers 4 or 5 cent power. But if that project in that community isn't creating jobs, if it isn't improving the quality of life for Alaskans, if it isn't supporting the economy and fitting in with the other investments the state's making in that community, it isn't really reaching the end game. On the other hand, 30 or 40 cent a kilowatt hour power in a rural community, maybe just getting down to that price may be the tipping point that makes an economy viable there for a fisheries or for a mine. And so you can't just take numbers and say this number works or that number works. And that's where the AEA structure and having a good project team for this program, for instance, the advisory committee that looks at that project. And so the question for these projects, and as a legislator, you say, how do we prioritize these to get the best business value and reach the end game with them? And one of those ways is to say, how does this energy project and our energy programs align with our business strategy for the whole state? And that's where the way these fit together works really well. Each successful project in the Renewable Energy Grant Fund reduces the demands on the PCE program, for example. So one thing I don't think you want to do in a tough environment is say, we're going to cut out this program. Maybe you take all the programs and you shrink them all a little bit so you keep that balance between the brick and mortar projects, the research and development part of your portfolio, the keep the lights on, block of granite that is the PCE program that holds up some of the rural communities until they can find those past success or get their turn at the renewable energy project or the emerging energy technology program. So hopefully some of those thoughts and frameworks can give, you know, help with a little different perspective on how these programs work. In my community, we had two renewable energy grant fund projects I wanted to talk about a little bit. One was we just happened to be putting a shovel in the ground on a hydroelectric project, and so we were, Cordova is one of the earliest and biggest recipients of this program, and we got $8 million for our Humpback Creek project. And it's saving $1 million in diesel fuel a year. Operationally, it's gone from hundreds of thousands of dollars to tens of thousands of dollars in annual operations and maintenance. That frees up resources in our community to provide better service, reduce our operating cost, pass on value to the citizens. But the real importance is, it's the additional capacity, it's the lower cost energy for our fishing industry that's allowed that industry to grow to, in our little community of 2,300 people, the fifth largest seafood delivery port by dollar value in the country. Hmm. And that's a huge success story. And the energy cost and availability and reliability in our community from our hydroelectric investments from the state has, and there's a direct return on investment to the state because the raw fish tax revenues have increased so substantially. And that's a cost share between the state of Alaska and the municipality, the city of Cordova. So both of those organizations are getting the financial support, the return on investment from that project.
So, Clay, mention that again. Cordova now has the fifth largest.
In 2010, we had a really big year, and it was, I think, this eighth or ninth largest volume of seafood delivered by a U.S. port, and it was the fifth largest dollar value. So that put three of our communities in the top five dollar value of seafood delivered in the country.
As a direct result of having available cheap power.
Absolutely. Because as diesel fuel prices went up really high, your offshore floating processors are still relying on diesel fuel, where onshore, building the two hydroelectric projects, got that tipping point down to where the product started moving onshore, investments in plants started happening, all the support businesses started growing, and it just really turned an economic corner. And, you know, it happens at 20 cents a kilowatt hour because In other communities, again, it isn't just the price. It's how does that fit into what's the business case for your project? How does it reach the strategic objectives of, sustainable businesses and communities?
Excellent. And, Rep. Hughes has a question as well.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Clay, for sharing that story. And actually, you answered part of it because you said that you're at 20 cents is a kilowatt.
That's kind of the all-in to our processor rate class. That's the all-in cost. So if you take all the taxes, fees, and everything, and divide how much the power they paid for and how much they used, it worked out to 20 cents a kilowatt hour.
Can you tell us just to give us, because Cordova is what I consider a medium-sized community, but it's not right in the highest population area either, and it takes a little bit to get there. How Cordova fits in the cost of power from urban to rural, like the low to the high, and kind of where Cordova ranks?
I think Cordova's kind of mid-range. As fuel cost has become, especially in gas, has become more significant, some of the utilities, Fairbanks, Homer Electric, their residential rates are getting very, very close. Where our rates are getting very close to theirs. Now our residential rate is still quite a bit higher. It's more in the 35 to 40 cent range, depending on how much hydro we get. So those are still probably about mid range.
How much of your power comes from hydro, and are you still using diesel also? Or
we are. Our two projects, we didn't have good geology to build storage dams to store the water. Otherwise, we'd be essentially 100% hydro year-round. We have run-of-the-river projects where we're pretty much 100% hydro all summer long, and that's where all of our industrial use, 60% of our sales happen in the summer months. So that's a real good fit for those projects. But that's the feast side of the story. The famine side of the story is by April, those rivers are pretty much frozen up, worn out. So all the small businesses, the residential, their electric rates pretty much triple. From their $100 electric bill in the summer goes to $300 by April, because that fuel cost keeps stacking on until we're pretty close to, and sometimes 100% diesel by April. So, and that's where we, yeah, that's just the...
Oh, I'm confused because I think things are melting in April. Explain.
Well, they melt at sea level, but for the hydroelectric projects, the water itself usually comes from up in the mountains, and it's later into May and June where you start getting the snow melt, the glacier melt, that puts the water in the pipe up at 2,000 or 3,000 feet before it comes into town. Okay. So, yeah, it can be spring and green grass down in the community, but up where the hydros are, we're still waiting for this sun to shine down into the valleys and give us the water. So.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
That's a good point. That's a good question. So anyway, the business case. And then the other project I want to mention briefly was not as successful. The project itself wasn't a success. And from a legislator's perspective, sometimes you say, well, you can point to the failures and say, this is a failure, that's a failure, that's a failure. But one of the things about project management and managing and prioritizing the portfolio of projects, if you can very deliberately take a technology that has a lot of risk and put it in a place where it has the highest possibility of being successful, in our case it was organic Rankine cycle heat recovery on a diesel unit. We didn't have any heat loads that we could deliver the heat to, so we decided let's try converting that heat to electricity and putting it back onto the grid. We've had some success with it. We're getting an extra 5% out of our diesel generator. That kind of extra efficiency is like turning a Volkswagen into a Maserati. That's a huge difference in fuel savings. But the project itself has been very painful. It took a lot longer to complete. It cost a lot more than we expected. But we made a very deliberate decision to pursue that. We put it in a capable utility's hands. We're a refrigeration community with our fish freezing. Good place to try it. And it has had some tremendous challenges. But the strength of the AEA network and measurement of these projects says, okay, now there's 10 other utilities out there that they're either going to fix the problems that the project we had to make it really work for them, or they're going to wait until the technology improves. So, let's make one deliberate mistake and learn from it instead of five or six communities charging into it and all learning the hard lessons at the same time. So sometimes those failures from a business perspective and from the global energy problem perspective are really successes. And so don't always look at those failures as just failures. We learn a lot from them. taking up a lot of time here, and I'll try to move along, but that kind of covered
this is good, and just to let you know, we have an hour and a half.
Okay. I'm just trying to, again, give you a perspective and some insights into how these programs work with some specific examples. And this is a great one, the Emerging Energy Technology Fund. So when we look at our energy program portfolio, this would be the high-risk piece. This is the R&D part, and it's appropriate for us to invest heavily here because Alaska has challenges that very few others have, and there's very wide variety of challenges, as wide as the expanse of the state, and challenges in one area are opportunities in other areas of the state. So one project that we did in Cordova, and again, the value that extends way beyond just the numbers in the project itself. Alaskan researchers discovered bacteria in the Arctic in the thermokarst lakes that can produce methane clear down to 0 degrees Celsius, right down to the freezing point. So that's an energy opportunity. If you can take bacteria, take household waste, cafeteria waste, and convert that to energy, the numbers are phenomenal. You can get hundreds times more energy out of a food digester, scrap food digester, for instance, than a manure digester, because the energy is still in the food. So
just for the record, is this a project you're working on?
This is an Emerging Energy Technology Fund grant project that had partners of the Cordova High School, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and ASEP, who helped govern it, and the Denali Commission kind of facilitated the administration of the grant in Cordova Electric Cooperative. And the project itself was successful in that we determined how feasible it is on a residential, in a rural area, on a commercial scale. But to me, the huge value of the project was getting the high school students involved. They were the ones who collected the cafeteria waste, measured the gas production, and the one student in particular that really took ownership of the project and got excited about it and passionate for it, when she graduated from high school, got a full ride scholarship at Princeton in the sciences. And to me, that alone was the value for that particular project. So there's ways that you can overlap energy and education projects and get a lot more value beyond just the economics.
Well, I do hope that it produced more than one student.
Oh, yeah. No, we had a lot of students involved in that project.
Excellent.
Was fish waste part of that? You have processing there, and were they using fish waste at all?
You know, the good news, bad news about the fish waste, and this is back to the hydro again, Copper River salmon are high in oil content. The processors were under there as they brought the fish on shore. They had all kinds of environmental constraints on the waste they were producing, so they disassembled a fish oil plant in Mexico, reassembled it in Cordova, and they're producing very high value fish oil, pharmaceutical grade salmon oil for the market, and the secondary byproduct is organic fish fertilizer. And so, again, on the back of lower cost electricity, what a great story, closing down businesses in Mexico and rebuilding them in coastal Alaska. So that waste stream has so much higher value there that we didn't even have it available.
Wow.
So the great thing about this program, though, is the collaborations. It brings the science community in. It brings private partnerships in. It brings technical expertise out into rural areas and into Alaska that otherwise wouldn't be there. So it's an important part of the portfolio. And our recommendation is that you fund it at the level that the AEA recommends and continue to fund this program. The Power Cost Equalization Program, as I kind of mentioned earlier, this is the block of granite that many of the rural utilities rest on. This is the Keep the Lights On survival program for the communities. And we very much appreciate the support of the legislature and administration fully funding this program last year and encourage you to do it again. I guess an internal example I can give you in again, this is a program that we want to eliminate organically. We want to come up with such good alternatives and solutions that we don't need the program anymore. And that's kind of what's happened. Even though Cordova Electric is still a PCE recipient, we've gone from the number one recipient in dollar value I think it was about 10 years ago I looked at it, one of our internal goals is to get off the program. And but now we're usually in the 30th or 40th largest dollar value recipient. We're getting half of the dollar value back from the program, even though fuel cost is 6 times higher and we're producing much more energy. We're only getting half of the funding that we used to. So that's a 1/12 shrinkage in that program. And that's the other benefit of the emerging energy technology.
So you're able to do that and still meet your fixed cost demands because of different efficiencies you have, not exactly. Just in lowering costs, but also in operations?
Exactly.
Could you explain that a little bit?
We've been able to, operationally, we've tightened our belt where we can, everywhere we can, and exercise as much fiscal constraint as we can to keep our rates from rising. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the promises we made when we made got grant funds from the state, is we are going to put these to the rates where and when we can. And so we were able to go through a series of rate reductions against rising operating costs. We've had to raise some of those in areas, not so much because of our cost, but because of investments we've had to make in our infrastructure to keep up with our growing processor rate class, the additional wire size, additional generation. And so if I answered that a little bit, we've been able to have some operational efficiencies, but mostly we're using a lot less diesel fuel. We're running more efficiently by the way we operate, and the rate reductions and the rate separation. You know, the PCE funding is based on rail belt cost and our 5 utility costs, including Juno. So as their costs rise a little bit and ours stay static, we just qualify for less the way the formulas work. So the formulas have just given us less and less need and use of that program. So,
The reason for the question is, as I'm sure you appreciate, some of your members have said that with the reduction in PCE, they also have a harder time meeting their fixed cost obligations. So I'm just comparing that to what you're saying and commend you for it.
It does. It puts pressure on your rates. And I mean, you know, the goal of these programs and the Alaska Energy Authority is to reduce energy cost, and that's a good measurement because that's what puts disposable cash in people's pockets. It's what allows businesses to compete. And those pressures are there, and they have to also be managed. The PCE can't be the whole solution, but it is a huge part of the solution.
So if I may, as an association then, you work with all of your members, and I suppose any other utility that asks you for help using you as a model, I mean, some of them who are having the struggle that they're not able to do as much cost containment, do you folks, how do you relate with some of these other utilities to help them out?
We have some really good networks, and that's one of the key roles of the Alaska Energy Authority. The Alaska Energy Authority, the Denali Commission, we'll get to that slide, Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, who has 55 of those rural communities. Those are three of the mechanisms that basically share a lot of the rural communities that don't have the community champions, the community expertise to own and operate their electric systems to the most efficient and cost-effective manner. And those are good roles for the Alaska Energy Authority. And the great thing about having those umbrella organizations is not only do they communicate real well internally, so that's why when I go to a rural energy conference sponsored and I hear that King Cove no longer gets any PCE because they built a hydro project and just got their rates down to where they no longer qualify, that's what actually, that's a good goal. Let's work ourselves off the program, and, you know, instead of forcing the program to cut us off of it. Then over time we can adapt to it. But that information sharing and then that structure of that, and that's it. That's the backstop. That expertise has to come from somewhere else, that assistance. Yeah, go ahead, Crystal.
And then to talk a little bit about Alaska Power Association and our role. So we're the trade association for the electric utility industry. And as I mentioned, we have a managers group. It's called the APA Managers Forum. And this group is composed of the member utility managers from around the state. They get together frequently throughout the year. And there's a lot of good networking and also information sharing. Some of them have mutual aid agreements with each other. And I think, and there's great success stories. For example, I remember many years ago, there was the North Slope Borough Power and Light needed a generator, and we sent an email out to all of the managers, and I think it turned out that the utility in Juneau, I think it was AELMP, was able to help them get a generator. And so there's a lot of information sharing that way and helping each other, and I think there was even a story, some sharing with Cordova and MEA pretty recently that worked out as well. So there's a lot of support there within our organization to help each other.
Excellent. Thank you for explaining that.
Yeah, the communication is really good. So the Denali Commission, state funding match for the Denali Commission. The Denali Commission is a structure. It's an engine that has been going out and building. Again, mostly in rural areas, the whole focus of the Denali Commission has been rural infrastructure in a variety of venues. And the fuel tank farm is one particularly good example, because right now it's a current issue, the contamination sites all over rural Alaska. And so the Denali Commission has been well-funded. They have over $400 million of projects that are very clearly identified as priority projects, and the Denali Commission has taken a measured approach to chipping away at those projects, a few a year, and working towards, just working through their project portfolio. They've been very well-funded at the federal level. That funding has gone away, so we have this structural framework that works. One of the Denali Commission's requirements was to have a minimal administrative overhead, and 4% is a number that I remember for a lot. But they wanted to put the money to work. They didn't want, and so this is another brick and mortar program. And because of the partnership between the AEA and the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative and the Denali Commission, that they've shared administrative resources, project priorities, the maintenance and ownership commitment at the tail end to make this program successful. This is very simply a matter of, for every dollar, it's a way of spending $2 and putting $3 to work. And as the federal funding for the Denali Commission shrinks, to the extent that the state can match that and demonstrate commitment to the program and the success it's having, we think it'll keep that federal match up and keep these projects moving forward. This is the ounce of prevention in upgrading these fuel farms before they fail catastrophically that hopefully will keep the 300 or whatever it is contaminated sites from becoming 400 sites down the road. So,
Rep. Hughes?
Clay, you may not know this. I'm just curious how much money has gone into energy product from Denali, the federal dollars over the years from the Denali Commission and the all-time high annual amount and what it is now. Do you happen to have that information?
You know, I got some help. $500 million to date has gone through the Denali Commission to rural projects. This year's funding is $13 million, so to match that program funding would be $26 million from the state. The administrative capabilities are there. The projects are identified and needed before a project gets through the committee recommendation approval process. There have to be commitments to the ownership, maintenance, and operation of the project. So it's a good structure that's in place, and rather than reinventing a new process, this is one that's just run out of gas and we're just saying pour gas in the tank.
Okay. Was it always set up with a 200% match from the state?
No, the state has contributed very little. That's the number I don't have, is what the state's match has been, if any.
Thank you.
That's a good question, because as I was just referring back to the resolution itself, it's saying that the APA urges the state of Alaska to provide 200% matching funds, but it doesn't say how much Denali Commission is doing, and so Yeah. I made a phone call in late last night to try to, or late yesterday afternoon to try to find the answer, but haven't heard back yet.
We did too. We and $13 million is what we heard the federal funding was this year. Frankly, that was more than we expected, and that's a success in that part. But we think unless the state steps up and matches that, the federal part's going to keep shrinking.
So if the PCE sheds, the endowment fund sheds 56,000 or 56 million, let's say, and we only need 44 million, should we use the other portion either to go back into the fund for inflation proofing, as it were, or should we use it as part of the match for these tanks?
You know, I'm just going to point to TERS PERS. And what happens when you have changing economic conditions and you don't let the earnings of a fund accrue to that fund? Eventually, if you have the economic downturns and you've skimmed those returns off, you're not assuring the long-term viability of the program. I mean, if you ask me, Clay, that question, I would say let the and I know it's very tough in a financial climate to say, man, we don't have the dollars. Let's go. That program right now, I think, is adequately funded. It's revolving. If you leave that alone, that's one less problem you're going to have down the road. I'd hate to see that end up where it was 10 years ago, where it wasn't adequately funded. And, you know, we're wringing our hands. Legislators are wringing their hands saying, how are we going to prop this program up? It's essential. So,
unless we can move all the communities
unless
to the
we
success
keep,
category
yeah.
And everyone has
yeah, exactly.
equal rates. Right?
And that's how these programs fit together. And some are short-term stopgaps, and some are longer-term, you know, chip away at that with solutions. And then some are R&D that take us over the horizon or around the hill to the future. So,
Rep Hughes?
You mentioned that if the state doesn't match it, that that you think it'll phase out and there won't be any federal dollars eventually. Are you specifically hearing that, or is that just your gut feeling? Are we hearing that from a delegation?
I hear that anecdotally, just in our network. There's a piece of the Denali Commission, I think it's a $4 million piece this year, that's kind of set up, and it's tied to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and that piece is fairly well intact. But a lot of it's discretionary at the federal level. And this is just part of the bigger message of Alaska has been given a lot of federal resources over the years. You have your own money, invest in your own infrastructure. So that's kind of anecdotal. I can't give you specific examples.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be helpful for us to know what, you know, through our federal delegation, what they're hearing, because
yeah,
that if it truly would be a loss, that's important for us to know in the budget process.
And my understanding is similar to what you've stated, Clay, is they're basically working off of settlement funds, and they're not getting much. Mm-hmm. But I'll follow up with our delegation and get back to you.
Okay. Well, I'd like to pass the mic to my esteemed colleague from Matanuska Electric Cooperative. And Joe's going to touch on much bigger concerns, more global and just larger in nature. Thank you.
Thank you, Clay. It's always daunting to follow such an eloquent speaker as Mr. Copeland is. He hit a lot of exceptionally important issues to APA and the industry in total. He did mention organic Rankine cycle, and I know you will want to hear more about that, but I'm not going to give it to you.
Oh, that's because I did write it down.
And I'm not going to talk about volt-amp reactants either, so I'll just get right into the issues here. One of the comments or questions was, do we have a mutual aid type arrangement? We certainly do in the rail belt. Somebody needs help, they call up and ask for it. We provide, we are in the process of building through ArcTech a listing of material that's available at the various utilities. So if someone needs a piece of equipment, they can check a list and see if it's available. The first thing we're going to talk about here today is a resolution on energy policy for the state. This is a point that's near and dear to your heart, Mr. Chairman. I've heard you wax eloquently on it again and again and again, and it's entirely appropriate. The closest we have to an energy policy is the renewable standards we've set, that was during the Palin administration, 50% renewable by 2025. It's going to be difficult to make that one alone, let alone any of the other standards we have. We believe that we need an energy policy plan. We've stated an implementation plan. First, you got to have a policy before you can put a plan together to implement it, but you would hope those would operate in lockstep. The industry does need support, financial support, for an awful lot of what it's doing, and you heard some of the points that Clay made earlier. We say long-term generation and transmission facilities. The long pole in that tent is transmission in the rail belt and statewide. Anywhere you look, there's a shortfall in transmission capability, and you might ask, why is that? And it's really hard in a lot of cases to show a profit on a transmission facility. They're just almost a cost element and nothing else. Except in the case of Bradley Lake, where you can deliver exceptionally inexpensive power to big users across the rail belt. On the generation side, the rail belt utilities have invested over $1 billion and soon to add another couple of hundred million when MLNP spools up its Plant 2A construction. What we now need is transmission dollars, and I'm not going to delve in that any great degree. You've heard the stories from about what the limiting factors are there.
And just for the record, Co-Chair Millett did drop in a bill that was read across yesterday, HB 340. And
yeah.
So that is scheduled for a hearing mid-March?
19th, I understand.
So we will delve into that that question a lot more. So
good.
Thank you.
Okay. And that's entirely appropriate to hear the logic behind that. And that really aims at the ISO, the independent system operator concept for the rail belt, and I have another slide that will hit some of that in a moment or so. Another point on this slide shows fuel development and storage. Certainly fuel development. You all recall just very recently we had near crisis situations on gas supply for rail belt. That's the bulk of it, 80% of it is natural gas generation. Very little backup, not enough to carry the entire load if you had to burn an alternative fuel. And we were at the point, we the utilities, of importing liquefied natural gas, probably from Canada. That was not received well in this building and other important big buildings in Anchorage, like 700 West 7th. Fortunately, along came Hillcorp and helped us out on this, and those people have done a yeoman's effort in opening up the fuel situation in Cook Inlet, at least through 2018. And I can thank the AG also, who stepped in and headed off an FTC problem with Hillcorp acquiring all of the gas facilities, essentially, that remain, except for the Conoco and MLNP piece of it, and they own a third of that. But they came across, they worked with all of the utilities, and they have given us a price through March of 2018 that's market realistic and I think a benefit to the entire rail belt. The storage program was the SINGSA on the Kenai, Cook Inlet, I've forgotten the term, but anyway, it's owned by the owners of NSTAR, and many of the utilities have a portion of that gas that can be delivered to them if they need it. Clay mentioned the PCE basing on rail belt costs, and I think this is an important point that often goes unnoticed. The PCE payment is geared to what the costs in the rail belt are. So if the costs in the rail belt go up, It affects the utilities all over the state through PCE. So be sure and look at those formulas. Okay. Capital funding for energy projects. ArcTech has a request in that I, and you have the books there. You can look at that, and we'll talk about it later if you want to. The major energy projects do need funding. The utilities are funded out with the generation we have built. The smaller utilities across the state are always strapped for capital. The Power Project Loan Fund does provide some, that's operated by EA, provides some possibilities of funding. The recently approved state-funded revolving loan fund called the SETS Sustainable Energy Program for financing infrastructure has $250 million in it, but to show you what it takes, the estimate of a recent AEA study to fix the rail belt transmission system was $900 million. The plant I am currently building at Eklutna is at the moment about $315 million, so these numbers quickly overtax the ability of that fund to fund anything. And so there's one that you could put, and it's borrowing authority. So it's a fairly easy thing for the state to say, we'll back up a certain amount of debt, and then people get a less cost debt and access to funding.
Joe, before you go on, for the record, explain more of the Power Project Loan Fund and why you're saying it needs to be capitalized.
The Power Project Loan Fund has only funds projects less than $5 million, I believe it is. And it, anything above $5 million requires legislative approval. And if you're going to do that, you might as well go for a direct grant on it. They do fund feasibility studies, and there's a mechanism in there that if your feasibility study doesn't pan out, then it becomes a grant rather than a loan. If it does pan out, it's just added to the capital cost of the loan. But it's pretty much underfunded today. I don't know their exact authorization. Maybe you do, Clay.
I think there's about a $2 or $3 million balance.
So it's there. Very small.
So why put on the record why you're saying if it's more than a $5 million project and it has to come to the legislature, it might as well be a grant. Why not a loan or a combination? Explain that the rationale for that.
Well, it sometimes seems easier to get a grant for your area if you have the right legislators involved in it than it is to go through trying to get money attributed to another loan fund at some point. This, if they make direct loans from that, you need a pool of many millions of dollars, not $2 million. Now, for the villages, it may work for small projects, but it doesn't take much today in the way of electrical system projects to eat up $2 million. And if you're above $5 million, you've got to come to the legislature anyway, so you might as well go ask for a grant. And I'm sure it was never conceived that way when it was originally placed. And it is a vehicle that could still be used if one were to capitalize it at a higher level. And that's the reason we ask for that.
So if we capitalized it at a higher level, we would still be able to make some of these projects work instead of just pure grant to maybe have a grant-loan combination. Part of our problem is we don't have enough money to make all these grants. That's why, you know, you're showing us all the stars around the state and goes back to the idea of prioritization. And we do have these number of funds that you're pointing out to us. But to be able to pool that money so that it's replaced so that the next person in line can get it would be far better, in my estimation, than pure grants. We're passing the day at this moment in our budget and revenue cycles to to be able to do grants as much. And yet we need to get this type of infrastructure in place for Alaskans if we're going to have the settlement of our land. Rep. Hughes.
And just to add to that, it's too bad we didn't capitalize it a few years ago when we had the money. And I'm just wondering, is that something that we're annually putting money into that fund? Do you know if it's in the government? So
I think it was a single one-time shot, as I recall, and it hasn't been replenished since the original one, and I don't remember the date of it.
So that's...
We'll find out and let you know.
We're accruing a list of requested funds that you'd like to see funded. So
I think you've made the point, Representative Isaacson, that it's a good idea. The way to approach it probably makes a lot of sense. But if it's undercapitalized and the first person that goes in and buys a new diesel engine for Quethlic uses up every nickel that's in there today. Mm-hmm. And I think that was some of the basis behind Senator McGuire's efforts on the SETS program. She was trying to build, and if you recall, her language was originally $1 billion in that revolving fund, and it got trimmed to $250 million. And unfortunately, as you bring it down, it doesn't, isn't enough there to really do what you intended for it to do, and that money has been underutilized as well. The state has a tremendous ability to guarantee loans. In fact, that's what made Bradley Lake work back 25 years ago, as we sat in a room not much bigger than this in New York City, and the investment bankers said, well, how do we know that you're going to be able to carry the debt on this? And that was the point where the state had already said to the utilities, we'll give you half of it. And everybody looked around at everybody else and said, well, we got a captive audience. They have to have electricity. And they said, that's not good enough. So they looked to the state people, and they said, it's a moral obligation of the state. And we had a deal. Don't ask me what a moral obligation is, because I have no idea, but it worked.
It's a financial term.
I thought it was. But it was rather undefined. But the point was, it made a project that quick. And today, Bradley Lake is the largest facility in the state with the lowest cost, almost. There's only one other power project in the state that costs less, and that's the Iglutna Hydro facility that the feds gave it to us, so we didn't have to pay for it. So I think there's tremendous opportunities in both of those funds, and that would fall in an Alaska energy policy, how you use those funds and who implements them. Well, here's our favorite topic, natural gas pipeline. Half of all of Alaska's electric generation comes off natural gas. We simply have to have a supply to make it work.
And we should clarify that as half of the population.
Half of the population.
Thank you.
That's probably better.
Not geographic.
Probably a better way to... the poor folks who aren't on natural gas are burning diesel at ghastly sums. In some way, in our energy policy that I'm sure this committee will be drafting, has to deal with the problem in the rural areas with the cost of fuel. One way to start working on that is a natural gas pipeline. The state does have efforts underway that purportedly will bring North Slope gas to market. There has to be a market, and to have a market, you must be bigger than the railroad utilities are. And that cries then for an LNG export facility or some other infrastructure that would permit the use of reasonable quantities of North Slope natural gas. If you don't go to some other big market, we have to make our own. And today that market is locked up by Conoco because they own the only LNG processing plant in the state, and it is currently pretty much idled. The last bullet here is the use of royalty gas. Representative Isaacson, you and I have talked at length about this. That is a way to deal with the issue that we have, is to use our royalty gas. You, of course, always hear the shout that it's Article 8 doesn't permit it. You and I think, both agree that that's not what it says.
That's correct.
In fact, I believe we have an AG ruling that said you can use royalty gas in the state, and it is the highest and best use for the state.
It is in the law already. I used to use the word statute, but in this building, statutes can be changed. But the law is respected. We are the lawmakers. Statutes is law, but or our law. But the law states right now that there can be a negotiated contract with gas utilities for gas. And negotiated contract is another word of saying subsidized rate. It can be less than market rate. If you want to equate the two, and I prefer not to equate the two, but it means that the amount of money coming to the state treasury is not as great, because the money going to the community then is allowing economy to be grown and wealth to be created by private investment rather than subsidized by state dollars and largesse, $1 at a time as possible, and that's a bankrupt philosophy, and that's bankrupting us to this day. But you're right, royalty gas already is in law, that we can have negotiated rates with our utilities. So thank you for bringing that up. And for the record, I put that on.
I could not have said it better myself. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Here's another point that we have talked at length about in the past, and more this year than in the past. This is the Unified Transmission System CRI, and it says support the utility efforts to create a unified system for the rail belt, and that is a euphemism for an independent system operator, an ISO Transco concept. I'm happy to explain all of those and how they work if that's necessary on the record. But we are in the process of creating that as we speak. Last week, Friday, I believe it was, my staff and Chugach's staff got together and looking at what will it take to make this happen. That's the two biggest utilities in the state, and if we can make it come together, and I'm confident we will, then I think many of the others will be drawn in. I've also made an initiative to MLNP in Anchorage to become a part of it. Since they are situated essentially where we are, it makes a lot of sense. And in that case, then you would define the independent system operator that ran the whole transmission system, and you would define custody transfer points somewhere on the Kenai and probably Healy up north. So north of the range does their own load balancing and dispatching. South of some point on Kenai, either Quartz Creek or Soldotna, Homer does its own. The rest of us all fall under one Transco ISO concept. And there is the bill dropped in by Senator Michiki and by Representative Millett does that. And it brings a study forward that would answer the questions that many of the agencies, most particularly the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, who has no real idea how they might be tasked to support that at this point. I have had discussions with the chairman about it, and I assured him that we know how to do it, and we'd be happy to pass that information on. He wasn't convinced that we were speaking not with a forked tongue. But and he has asked for the study, and I think it's entirely appropriate. So you have seen that language, and I shan't go over it at this point. I've waxed eloquently to everyone who will listen about the fact that we do not have a robust grid, and if we did, and that's been verified by a study done by AEA last summer, that said there are savings upwards of $250 million a year if you do certain things to the transmission system. And everybody says, my goodness, where could all that money come from? And it's from economic dispatch primarily. And we must do that. I don't think we can continue. And if we do a rather small fix to the system, you're still looking at substantial savings to the membership. And what does that do? Drives your rates down, makes your system more robust, and fosters economic development. As you heard Clay mention earlier, what has happened in Cordova? All of that occurred because of inexpensive power and compared to burning diesel on a boat.
Joe, and I appreciate you have been very, very diligent and very educational on this. But if you have a $250 million savings on a $904 million investment, $250 per annum, don't you feel that that would be bankable? You could go and get private funds at that point, all other factors being considered as far as ownership, et cetera.
The limiting factor is the utility's balance sheet. And every one of us at the moment is right at our debt limits because of all the generation we've built. As I said, we'll have built $1.2 billion worth of generation inside of a year or two. And that has us pushing on our debt covenants very tightly. And without the ability to take on the additional debt, the utilities simply are hamstrung. You cannot go get additional money if you're that close to your debt covenants that already exist. And every one of us has everything, every asset we have is mortgaged. So there is no pool of mortgageable assets anywhere out there.
And that's the devil in the details when you're trying to create a Transco ISO model.
And yes, and the hope being that then as this slowly develops, that these people in the ISO and the Transco will be able to build create the ability to take care of the system and eventually build it out. If you had a large grant on the front end, you could do exactly what you're saying. But you got to get over that front end hump on financing. And right now the utilities do not have the ability to do it. I know AEA says we do. We can finance it with savings. I have never been able to spend any savings anywhere. So it's hopeless when you go to the bank and say, well, I'm going to look how much I'm going to save. You still have to have the ability to take on that extra debt. And that's where we're limited today.
So that's a good prelude to the 19th.
It is, yes.
Thank you.
We, Bradley Lake financing model, we've also talked at length about that to most of you. That originally, as I said, that was a 50-50 idea between the state and the utilities. The utilities pick up the debt service on half of it, and throughout the lifetime plus whatever it exists, we pay essentially the same amount for power. Today that runs about $50 a megawatt hour. Delivered from the at the bus bar of the facility. Again, as I mentioned, it's in effect the cheapest large source in the state of Alaska, so it is the screaming success of all of the projects we've done. We believe that is a reasonable financing model. It gets more difficult if you put billion-dollar projects in there, and maybe 50-50 again is more than the utilities can choke down. But that is that public-private partnership concept works. It worked on Bradley, and we think it'd work on future projects. Metals theft. Believe it or not, we got people stealing our metal, our copper. And it's not just a few. It's a lot going on. There's many examples in the last year of copper theft because the price of copper is so high. And you say, well, how bad can that be? So they steal a reel of copper. Well, first, it comes out of your members' pockets. You and I are all paying for it. Secondly, they will go through trucks and equipment and things of that nature and strip out the copper. And then you lose the ability of that asset to support your mission. So the cost becomes staggering to rebuild something as simple as truck engines, where people have taken the copper and walked away with it. There isn't a bill out there yet, but there are a lot of people, AGC, Associated General Contractors, are pushing pretty hard, and the reason they're interested is because they're losing equipment and things of that nature. We have to guard every bit of it. I've spent a lot of money in the last year in my own storage yard, putting cameras in and what have you, and big fences to protect it. And I suppose there is no answer other than to put in more ability to protect ourselves. But it does cost us. It cost, you know, that we had some cuts of actual energized lines where people cut the lines and walked off with them. Well,
what?
Yes.
They're energized.
Energized lines. So,
so they knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Is it inside jobs?
You also see, well, it could be. And MTA had one about a year ago that was an inside job. The individual just loaded up a couple of reels of copper and drove off. And these reels weigh thousands of pounds. They're as tall as this room. So there's a lot of copper in there.
Just out of curiosity, what are one of those reels cost, and then what have the investigations shown as far as what they're doing with once? But how are they?
They market it through the scrap dealers, and that's part of what this legislation, if it gets drafted this session, will show. It will allow you to track any kind of copper or other unique metals that come in through the scrap dealers. They will have to have a track record on it. And that's what the AG is working on right now, I understand.
So what's a reel worth?
I just signed the buys on, I don't, do you know, Clay?
Well, you know, for a good example is underground cable. We have a lot of underground utilities, so that you have the wire in the middle, but you have all this insulation and high-tech coatings and stuff, so it'll run $3 a foot for a $2,500 or 2,500-foot reel. So $7,500 for a reel of wire sitting there. And unfortunately, they might steal this reel, but then they back a forklift into the other reel and or whatever. But so the copper itself is just a small part of the material value. So they may only get $1,000 or $500 of scrap value, but they're wrecking a $10,000 reel of wire. Yeah. Yeah. And that's on the low end for wire copper.
How frequently is this happening?
Quite a bit. We've had at least five or six major instances in the last year that I'm aware of. We at MEA alone have had in the last year three instances of theft, and each time they cut through the same spot in the fence, and some of them we watched. There was one just recently where they stole from the Eagle River yard. They crawled right under the fence. My dispatchers are watching it on TV, and they walked out with arms full of copper wire. They're that desperate that they will carry it out by hands.
So not to get into the weeds on this necessarily, but your dispatch obviously got on the phone to the troopers. And
well, not in a timely manner, but I had a discussion with them about that. I said, for
heaven's
sake,
think that would be something infernal.
Under our fence, you got to get the...
Someone's liable inside. That sounds like collusion. They should know that if they don't respond right away, that they're culpable.
Well, that was exactly the point that I made to them, and boy, that opened their eyes. But
well, let us know when this bill, Jeff was saying also, as I think you said it as well, it's still being worked on with the AG's office, and if this is that big of a deal, I would hope that we would get to it before this session's over. Otherwise,
well,
it's going to be another year.
One to deal with. It simply requires a track on scrap metals coming into these recycling spots, and that's probably a pretty good way to do it. It's already illegal to steal stuff.
Yeah.
So
and it sounds easy, but I imagine like any chop shop, they can disguise the source. They're not selling a big spool to a scrap yard.
No, they probably sell it in pieces and. Yeah. And it is expensive for the utilities, and it's our membership that's carrying the
absolutely
cost of it today.
Yeah.
That's our presentation. We're happy to discuss any and all of the resolutions or any other topic that...
From what you have asked us, basically, my notes say you're asking us to fully fund the Renewable Energy Fund, the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, PCE, the World Tank Cleanup to the tune of 200% match to Denali Commission, the transmission lines, the metal theft, I forgot the Power Project Loan Fund and SETS. Am I missing anything?
Well, I guess we ought to throw in the UAF power plant up there. They're going to have to do something there, too.
The idea that we are going to have to do something on the power plant, but one of the things that we've got as a constraint is that the federal government isn't allowing coal plants to really exceed their current permit, and it's too bad because we've never really gotten a coal plant the size necessary to displace the diesel. And you've heard me talk about that a lot. And fortunately, there's a bill that's been dropped in to urge the governor to examine that. And as you heard Senator Kelly say yesterday, it's the by God principle. Just build it. It's on state land. By God, get it done. I like it. The university coal plant, if we could build it maybe 3 or 4 times the size, not only would it displace some diesel, but it would provide excess generation that is required by some of our mining projects in the interior that desperately need to get their costs lowered, as well as refining and so forth. So I'm sure that there's a move. I know that there's a move to get that funded this year. We're constrained by permit size, and it is a combined heat and power. Trying to get as much benefit for any one project. Here we are in Alaska, in the interior. We have 100,000 people, and we have 5 coal plants, plus 3 big diesels, plus, you know, on and on and on. And it's kind of like we're doing things backwards in the state, and it's time we got off the transient mindset. We're just here. Let's just coddle something while we're here and let the other people figure it out, and we need to figure this out. So that for the long run and the project size, we need to scope it. We can never get enough electricity in this state. The day that we think that we have is the day that we have not looked for markets. We call ourselves the end of the road, and I don't want to wax on too much, but I do want to set this up. We call ourselves the end of the road, and so we get despondent and think, you know, some people think that's freedom, but we know that regulation follows us everywhere. But we need to turn that around. If we're the end of someone else's road, we're the beginning of our road. Microsoft had to leave from, had to go offshore in 2008 for some of their computer, what we call cloud storage now, I guess, their computer stations, because even in the Pacific Northwest with really cheap hydro, they had maxed out their capacity, and so they had to go overseas. What if we created enough inexpensive electricity that we could bring those back to domestic continental U.S.? How much more secure would that be for our data servers and so forth? And on and on. But a lot of people say no to a lot of these things because right now, as they see it, market conditions don't work. When we own the resource, we set the price. Therefore, we set the market conditions, and we must start thinking that way. And that will help us to figure out how we fund all of these different funds that have been created. Plus then make sure that we can get a return on investment like an emerging technology fund, as was we talked about in the last meeting, and we may see a bill on that one, but then also these other funds that we have. So any other thoughts on that? We're definitely open-eared. Rep. Hughes, your turn.
I just want to thank you. I don't have anything additional. I appreciate the update. I look forward to I was just checking to make sure that we were hearing HB 340, which we are, because if we wouldn't, I would have asked more about this, and I know you did mention it, but we'll have a chance, and I'm sure you'll weigh in when we come to that. So that's the next thing I'm looking forward to. So thank you.
Well, if there's not anything else, oh, look, I have an agenda. If there's not anything else, Let me just read through the script to make sure I'm not missing anything. Our next Energy Committee meeting is Monday, March 3rd at 8 a.m. We will hold a joint hearing with House Special Committee on Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism. Representative Shelley Hughes will chair that meeting. And we're going to talk about dirigibles, airships with Curtis Zell, and biofuels with Michael Smith. And then later in the week, energy co-chairs will be attending the Energy Council meetings in Washington, D.C. So, this upcoming things. Thank you very much for your presentation. You've given us a lot of food for thought. I'll have staff work on preparing a budget worksheet as a talking point to the for this committee and others in the House. And perhaps in the other body to make sure that we understand the dollar figures that we're talking and perhaps we can point out some of the useful benefits and especially if it has the ability to recoup as in the sense of a loan probably would get looked on favorably. So thank you for highlighting these issues for us and thank you also for your work on behalf of Alaskans to bring low-cost delivered to the consumer, electricity. Appreciate your efforts. And with that,